Good day and welcome to the American Constitution Society, What's Next? Hall versus Florida and the Future of Death Penalty Jurisprudence Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mrs. Jill Dash. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jill Dash, Director of Lawyer Chapters here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you so much for joining us for today's call, What's Next, Hall versus Florida and the Future of Death Penalty Jurisprudence. Please note that today's call is being recorded. We will provide the recording to those who RSVP'd after the call. This is the second in our summer series of What's Next calls, where experts in our network discuss the past U.S. Supreme Court term. 0.5 hours of California CLE credit is available for this and all of the other calls in the series. Please email Katie O'Connor at kocconnor@acslaw.org in order to get CLE credit. We will invite you to ask questions at the end of this call. Judging from the RSVP list, we'd like to say welcome to several new friends at the American Constitution Society. For those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a national member of ACS today. It is now my great pleasure to introduce to you Steve Bright, President and Senior Counsel for the Southern Center for Human Rights. Without giving away too much information about Steve's age, I will tell you it's very interesting to note that when he went to law school, the death penalty was unconstitutional and was thought not likely to return. Unfortunately, with Gregg versus Georgia, it did, but fortunately for us, Steve has become the consummate expert on the subject and has worked tirelessly in this field. He has argued before the Supreme Court, testified numerous times before the House and Senate. He's a prolific writer and speaker, and he has won numerous awards for his remarkable work, including the ABA's Thurgood Marshall Award. We are very fortunate at ACS to call him our friend and a frequent speaker at our events across the country. You will find no more passionate advocate or devoted lawyer. And now I give you Steve Bright.
Thank you, Jill. That's very generous. I appreciate it. I'm not sure I'm the consummate expert, but I have dealt with this for a little while. Welcome to everyone who's on the call. This case is an important case, Fraley Hall, because it deals with whether states can undermine the prohibition of executing the intellectually disabled simply by doing what lawyers are pretty good at doing, which is giving a definition to intellectually disabled, which excludes a lot of intellectually disabled people, which is, or create an evidentiary sort of demand, as Florida did, to keep evidence out or keep the issue from really being considered. And there are different variations of this, but I thought what I would do first is just give a brief review. Some of you are probably quite familiar with the sort of developments in this area of execution of the intellectually disabled, but some probably are not. Then talk a little bit about why the case is important, and then talk about Fraley Hall's case itself. This is a remarkable area because in 1987, not a single state prohibited the execution of the intellectually disabled. Then called mentally retarded. 15 years later, the Supreme Court decides that there's a national consensus against it and that it's unconstitutional to execute people who are intellectually disabled. The very first law passed on this was in Georgia after the execution of Jerome Bowden, who was so embarrassing, his last statement and the fact that he was so intellectually limited, that Georgia passed a law saying we're not going to ever do this again. First went to the Supreme Court in 1989. At that time, there were just two states. The next one was Maryland and the United States government. The court said that's not any kind of national consensus. and rejected it. And then in 2002, in Atkins versus Virginia, 18 states by then had passed laws prohibiting execution of, as I said, the terminology at that time was mentally retarded. Interesting, 20 states still had it, 20 death penalty states, but the court added together the 18 states that had passed laws prohibiting it with the 12 states that did not have the death penalty to get a 30-20 split on the states, and decided that this showed that the American society, under the evolving standards of decency, have come to the conclusion that we will not execute people, that there's a special risk that people who are intellectually limited, may be wrongly convicted, may be misunderstood because their passivity or their lack of reaction and so forth might be seen as being cold as opposed to being lack of understanding. So degree of culpability, retribution, those factors were taken in, and the court drops a footnote in which it defines mental retardation. It gives both the definitions in the American Psychiatric Association and what was then called the American Association of Mental Retardation, which was one, substantially sub-average intellectual functioning, usually tested on an IQ test, usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 or below. Second, deficits in adaptive behavior. And thirdly, that those were manifested in the developmental period, that is, while the person was a child before they were 18 years of age. But it didn't say this is the constitutional definition. So it seemed to me that if you have a constitutional rule that you can't execute a certain group of people, of course, children was another group that the court excluded after this, but you can tell how old somebody is just by looking at their birth certificate. They're either 17 and not eligible, or they're 18 and they are eligible for the death penalty. But some of the states have avoided Atkins. That was the decision in Atkins versus Virginia. By the way they define intellectual disability, or by the way they allocate the burden of proof. I mean, Florida here had a rule that said if you had an IQ score above 70, that's it. You couldn't put on any evidence of intellectual disability. That sort of conclusively resolved the issue against you. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and of course Texas is important since it executes far more people than any other state, 515 right now, compared to Oklahoma, which is in second place with 111. So Texas's view on this is quite important. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said that most Texas citizens would agree that Steinbeck's Lenny from Of Mice of Men, by virtue of his lack of reasoning ability and adaptive skills, that he would be exempt from the death penalty, but the Texans probably would not agree that a person who met the definition of mental retardation and was, for purposes of social services, or was diagnosed as intellectually disabled by a mental health professional, would be less morally culpable, and therefore they would not meet the definition. And then it gave a series of kind of loaded questions to ask about does the person have the ability to formulate plans? Does the person show leadership, or are they followed around by other people? Is the conduct in response to some stimuli, and is it socially acceptable? Does the person answer questions when asked? Can the person lie? Can the person hide facts? And did the crime involve forethought, planning, and complex execution of purpose? So basically looking at the crime and all these things, you could basically conclude a person who, every mental health expert who looks at this person, tests this person, says this person meets the definition, maybe has a 65 IQ, showed developmental disabilities early in their childhood, this person meets the definition, and yet under the Texas standard, a Texas jury could conclude that because this person is not like Lenny in Mice and Men, that person does not meet the definition. Georgia has set the standard of proof as beyond a reasonable doubt that the person who claims to be intellectually disabled, the defendant, has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they are. And a fellow named Warren Hill, whose case went before a judge, who said, I find by preponderance of the evidence that he meets the definition. I even find by clear and convincing evidence, but because there's some experts who question whether or not he meets the definition, I have reasonable doubt. So even though the evidence, just weighing at 50-50, it would indicate intellectual disability is not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which makes it virtually impossible for anybody in Georgia to be found intellectually disabled. I think that is a good target of what the future holds after this decision. But let's talk about Fraley Hall's case for just a minute. This is a case that dates back to 1979, so it's over 30 years old. Hall was tried the first time. Florida limited mitigating factors in death penalty cases to just a list in the statute, and intellectual disability was not one on it, so it wasn't even relevant. That was reversed. The Supreme Court decided a case called Hitchcock versus Duggar that says anything about the life and background of the person, the jury must be able to consider that. So he's tried a second time, and this time he puts on lots of it. This is still before Atkins has been decided, when it's still acceptable to execute people who are intellectually disabled, but it's a mitigating factor that might persuade a jury not to impose the death penalty. The lawyer from his first trial testified at his second trial that he really couldn't understand anything Hall said, that Hall could not assist in his own defense because he had a mental level much lower than his age, which the lawyer compared to his four-year-old daughter. There were lay witnesses who said he was slow in speech and slow to learn, that he walked and talked long after his older brothers and sisters, had great difficulty forming words, that his teachers and others recognized that he was significantly mentally retarded. And there were also several experts who testified in their professional opinion, using the terminology of that time, that Hall was significantly retarded, was mentally retarded, and had a level of understanding typically seen in toddlers. The judge noted that, said, there's no question Fraley Hall has been mentally retarded his entire life. He also pointed out that Hall grew up under the most horrible family circumstances imaginable. Nevertheless, he sentenced him to death. Noting what we see in these cases a lot, the judge said, nothing explains how a psychotic, mentally retarded, brain-damaged, learning-disabled, speech-impaired person could formulate a plan where a car was stolen and a convenience store was robbed, which is what happened in Hall's case. A young woman was killed, the car was taken, he went to the convenience store, it was Hall and another person, a police officer responded to try to apprehend them and was shot and killed. And that was those were the two homicides that brought Hall into the area of capital punishment. The death sentence was upheld in 1993. Chief Judge Rosemary Barquette dissented, saying that she thought executing a person with intellectual disability violated the Florida Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Well, the Atkins case is decided in 2002. And now Florida takes a different position. Now it decides that Hall is not mentally retarded. And so now he has another hearing on whether he meets the definition adopted in Atkins. He had received 9 IQ evaluations in 40 years, with scores that ranged anywhere from 60 to about 80, but only 2 were admitted. One had a score of 71, and one had a score of 80. The Florida Supreme Court had held, consistent with its decisions, that you must show an IQ score of 70 or below before you could present any additional evidence of intellectual disability. The Florida statute actually doesn't say that. The statute adopts pretty much the American Psychiatric Association definitions, significantly subaverage intellectual functioning existing concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior before the age of 18, the statute defines significantly subaverage intellectually functioning as performance that is two or more standard deviations from the mean on an IQ test. So 15 and 15 gets you down to 70. So far, so good. But then the Florida Supreme Court held that if you have a score over, a state called State versus Cherry, if you have a score above 70, that pretty much ends the inquiry. And that was the issue framed up for the Supreme Court in this case, and a very close case, very disturbing how close it was and how vehement the dissent. But Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, says that what Florida does here by excluding this evidence is disregard medical practice in two ways. It makes the IQ score a final and conclusive determination of intellectual capacity when experts in the field would consider other evidence, and it refuses to recognize the imprecision of an IQ test, that there is a standard error of measurement, 5 points above, 5 points below, whatever the test is. So fall out of 71, 5 points above and below. The court says this is at odds with professionals who design and administer IQ tests. Alito, in dissent, says the court is basing this on what these professional societies, psychologists and psychiatrists, define, their definitions, and that those change all the time, and that the Constitution can't depend on what definitions these professional groups have. Justice Kennedy and the majority try to move this back, or do move it back into sort of the more traditional Eighth Amendment analysis, which is to look at what are the practice in the states and what sort of is the consensus among states in terms of how you make this determination. And it found only 9 other states have such a strict cutoff as Florida. And the rest, including the 18 states that do not have the death penalty, counted against them. Now, Alito, again in dissent, says he wouldn't take the 18 states that don't have the death penalty into consideration. Basically, the court says that what Florida has to do is admit, and any state has to do, is as long as you're within the standard error of measurement, the courts can consider the kind of evidence that was presented at Hall's second trial, that is, teachers testifying about what his functioning was like when he was in school, family members talking about how well he adapted and whether he could, you know, catch the bus and make change and do things along that line, as well as how well he functions in society today, to make, based on all the evidence, not just an IQ score, but based on all the evidence, a determination of whether the person is intellectually disabled. If they are, they're not eligible for the death penalty, because the court finds that their degree of culpability is reduced, and because retribution doesn't have much force with regard to people who are intellectually disabled. So I think the important, obviously, to how Florida carries out the death penalty, a lot of people under death sentence in Florida. Most states are declining in terms of imposition of the death penalty. Florida seems to be kind of revving up and is going to be executing more people. So I think this will mean that a lot of people will have to be reevaluated or reassessed or get new trials on the issue. And I think it also calls into question the Texas practice and some other practices which have tried to define intellectual disability in a way that is too narrow to come within the Supreme Court's ban on executing those people. And I think it will probably be the end of Georgia's practice of requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt. One of the things that the court points out is that that other states, majority of other states, but the fact that only one state having a particular rule is not going to show a consensus, and that tends to indicate that Georgia's standard of proof, which would mean that people who are proven beyond a preponderance of the evidence are intellectually disabled, but not beyond a reasonable doubt, that would allow that group of people to be executed. It will happen with in the Hall case. But at any rate, I think this means that there's going to be strong effort to make sure that this prohibition of executing the intellectually disabled applies consistently all over the United States. And I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone the opportunity to signal for questions.
I'm just going to throw out a question while everybody is queuing up their own questions. Steve, I was curious what your take is on this in terms of, we have the court providing a way to narrow the application of the death penalty in this case, but is this a good development because it's narrowing the application of the death penalty, or is it the court trying to convince themselves that there's still a good way to do this and therefore it's bad for the effort to get rid of the death penalty entirely?
Well, that's an argument a lot of people have. If you're down where I am and you represent a lot of intellectually disabled people, this is a good decision because it means those people are not going to be executed. If you're up, looking at this more academically or something, you may not have that same sort of sense of the immediate with regard to it. But I think, in the mid-90s, states were sentencing about 290 to 310 people to death every year. That has come down now to where in the last 2 years only 79 people were sentenced to death. It's been below 100 for the last several years. There's just been an incredible decline. I think this will add to that because it will mean some people that are being executed or in line or in the queue for execution will not be executed. And I think the lower that number gets, if it ever gets below 50, and it's a handful of jurisdictions that are sentencing all these people, Harris County, Texas, Duval County, Florida, and some others, but most of the people sentenced to death in this country were sentenced by just a small minority of counties. One of the things the court has looked to in making its determination about whether the death penalty is appropriate at all or whether it's appropriate for a certain group of people like juveniles or children and intellectually disabled people, or whether it's appropriate for certain crimes such as where the person was an aider and abettor but not the actual person who pulled the trigger. It's looked at both what the states have done but also what is the practice. And if the practice continues to diminish in the way that it is, that would certainly put the court in a position someday in the future to conclude that the death penalty is, as Justice Stevens said, towards the end of his career on the bench, serves such a negligible law enforcement purpose that it really is not, that it's an excessive and unconstitutional punishment. So I think it moves in that direction. I'd certainly hate to think that the court would have come out the other way on this, which I think would have meant more people would be executed. And it would let states basically write the prohibition of executing the intellectually disabled out of their death penalty statutes just by the way they defined intellectual disability.
Thank you. I think we're waiting for another question. Roxy, you have anything in the queue?
Yes, we have a question from Carrie Miller.
Hi there. So I just had a question if you could comment further about the dissent. And you referenced some of this earlier about the criticism of sort of adherence to the medical community's opinions here, and it was a pretty strong criticism from Alito. And so I'm just wondering if you can comment about whether or not you think Kennedy did stay true to the traditional counting inquiry that was introduced in Atkins, and if anything, given the opinions in Roper and Graham, sort of revived that standard for Eighth Amendment jurisprudence now?
Well, I think he says that he, and I think he does, I suppose, apply that standard. It seems odd to me to apply it with regard to Florida's sort of evidentiary rule here that if you, unless you have an IQ score of 70 or below, you can't put on any other evidence of it. That is very odd, it seems to me, conclusion that the Florida Supreme Court reached with regard to the statute. But he does say generally, if we look at all the states, the overwhelming majority of states would consider the standard error measurement and would do it differently than Florida does. But when you really look at the opinion, he's relying upon, you know, he cites a lot to the brief of the American Psychiatric Association, and he's really talking a lot about what professionals and experts in the field do. But that's probably relevant in terms of coming up with a definition that is an actual definition of the group of people that we say are excluded. If the states can decide who, you know, which people are going to be classified this way, then they really can totally gut the Atkins decision. The case does include some of Justice Kennedy's sort of soaring language that he uses in capital cases. He says the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, which prohibits the execution of the intellectually disabled, it tells us about the kind of country we've been, the kind of country we are, and the kind of country we're going to be, which sort of suggests, you know, we're on a progression of narrowing the death penalty more and more. He wrote one of the other narrowing cases, which was Kennedy versus Louisiana, in which he said when the law gets into the area of death penalty, it risks its own descent into brutality and violating the standards of decency and so forth that we have. You know, he's troubled by the death penalty. He's troubled by applying it any more broadly. In fact, he said in, I can't remember which case now, but in one that, you know, we certainly are not, it may have been a Kennedy, we're not going to increase the number of people being sentenced to death. I mean, the court first upheld the death penalty in 1976, and then it starts trimming who's eligible and who's not, what crimes and what crimes not. Basically, it's got to be at least a homicide. The person has to at least have knowing, you know, knowledge that there's a great risk that somebody's going to be killed and participate with that, and so forth. The next, you know, juveniles and intellectually disabled. So I think this stays pretty true to that. It's your initial question about the dissent. I mean, it's really, you know, quite a very strong dissent by Justice Alito, who just takes on everything that the majority opinion says, and says that this standard error of measurement, that Kennedy doesn't even understand it, they don't even have it right, that actually what Florida does is they have multiple testing, and that's allowed, and that's more than sufficient to come up with a, quote, as he says, true IQ score. And then he does his own little standard error of measurement exercises about different deviations and using different numbers and so forth. It's an all-on attack on the majority opinion, and just shows you how delicate the balance is on the Supreme Court and how important it is who is the next person on it, because this case could have very easily come out the other way.
We'll take our next question from Zach Gima.
Hi. Given, you know, the Eighth Amendment restrictions on the death penalty on mentally incapacitated folks, how how can the court or any state justify having the burden of proof on the defendants themselves to show that they are not, just prove that they are intellectually incapacitated?
Well, they probably shouldn't, but the Supreme Court long ago held with regard to competency for trial. It used to be the states had to prove the person was competent for trial. That is, that they understood what was happening and they could assist their lawyers. They had a rational understanding of what's going on. They knew who the judge was, who the jury was, what the prosecutor did, and they could intelligently communicate with their lawyer. The court then, in a case out of California, Medina versus California, said that a state can put the burden of proof on the defendant to prove his competency, which really, when you think about it, doesn't make much sense, because if the person is incompetent, but of course what the court's thinking about is, well, the lawyer is the one who has to prove it. But then later in a case called Cooper versus Oklahoma, the court said you can't make the burden any higher than a preponderance of the evidence. Oklahoma had said defendant has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he is incompetent for trial. And the court said you can't do that because you could have people who have proven by a preponderance of the evidence that they're incompetent and they could still go to trial because they didn't meet the clear and convincing standard. And you can't take that risk of executing or trying someone who is incompetent. I think the same thing is going to apply with regard to the Georgia statute. I think the court is going to say you can require the defendant to prove it. You can require them to prove it by preponderance. That is, more likely than not, on a scale, 51% versus 49%, you can require the defendant to prove it to that extent, but you can't set any higher burden than that. I mean, the reasonable doubt standard is really only for guilt and whether or not you've really, burdens of proof are all about allocation of risk. And with regard to convicting an innocent person, we don't want to take any risk of executing an innocent person. So we say beyond a reasonable doubt. Still doesn't prevent that, but that's the goal. But with every other decision in civil cases and so forth, we normally set the burden of preponderance of the evidence. That is, what's more likely than not. So I think the fact that Georgia is a complete outlier, again, if you do the analysis of the states, like Justice Kennedy did in Hall, you're only going to find one state that sets the burden of proof that high. And I think, you know, the 11th Circuit, actually a panel of the United States Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit, held in the Warren Hill case that the standard violated the Constitution, but then the en banc court took the case and decided that under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, it couldn't reach that issue because it wouldn't apply the law retroactively. It wasn't that it wouldn't apply the law retroactively. It was that there was no clearly established Supreme Court decision on the burden of proof. And of course, the dissenters said, well, wait a minute, this is eligibility for the death penalty. Goodness sakes, surely we can address it. But the majority of the en banc court rejected that. The Supreme Court denied certiorari. Warren Hill's in the queue to be executed by Georgia. And so it's been the same thing has happened in the Fifth Circuit. But I think eventually the Supreme Court will take the issue on a direct appeal from the Georgia Supreme Court.
We'll take our next question from Lindsay Sanders.
Yes, you kind of answered one question I had about whether you foresee further appeals that will bring into question other state standards or if the court will maybe hold off for quite some time. But if you want to elaborate on that further, I'd be happy to. But my other question as well is, I know Kennedy has been a proponent of using international law related to death penalty, especially the juveniles and death penalty. Did he bring that into the case this time?
No, and I think it would be somewhat of a stretch to go there for how you, determine this decision. Which goes to the first part of your question. I think the states that the court singled out, court basically said Kentucky, Virginia, and maybe Alabama and Arizona have this strict cutoff. If your IQ score is a certain number, then that's it. He said Delaware, Kansas, North Carolina, and Washington, you can't really tell, but it could be interpreted by their courts the way the Florida court interpreted this, but it hasn't been addressed yet. Well, I'd say the message pretty clearly to those nine states is they better interpret their statutes to allow all the evidence relevant to intellectual disability to be admitted. But I think there will... He does mention Texas in there, which has sort of its own homegrown of mice and men definition, and it'll be interesting to see whether that passes constitutional muster. I don't see how it could, but I could be wrong, of course.
Thank you.
And that's a gloss, the Texas definition based on mice and men as opposed to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. That's a court gloss. That's the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. I don't think facially there's anything wrong with the statute. But given what the court has said, and of course it will depend on how trial judges are instructing juries, but I think some of the questions that the court asks, and this is what comes up so often in these cases involving issues of intellectual disability. If the person could plan a crime, could take a gun to a scene and fire the gun to get money in a robbery, well, surely that person's not intellectually disabled because they've shown the ability to plan and to carry out a plan and so forth. Of course, a 10-year-old child can know that when the parents are out of the house, that's a good time to try to get in the cookie jar. It doesn't really show a really high level of intellectual functioning. But that's very often the issue, and of course that's exactly what the Texas court invites with these questions, is to say, look at what the guy did, and do you really think he's intellectually disabled, regardless of what the IQ scores are, what the evidence is of his adaptive behavior, and so forth.
We'll take our last question from Rachel Lopez.
So the case mostly focuses on the standard error of measurement, but I'm curious, given the Supreme Court's deference to the clinical definition, sort of a moving away toward deference to state definitions, I'm curious if you think that this will have any impact on other kind of widely accepted clinical measuring errors like the Flynn effect?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I doubt if the court, and this is just me, I certainly haven't thought about this very much, but I don't know how much the court's going to get in the high weeds with things like the Flynn effect, which for those of you that don't know is, you know, if you take a number of IQ tests, it affects the scores of the latter tests, and you can take that into account in trying to figure out what the ultimate score is or how it should be scored. I just don't know why. I'm sure that issue will be raised because there are going to be some cases where that comes up. On the other hand, I think that's generally accepted in the field, and probably you're going to have not that many people are going to say you can't take it into account. So I don't know. I would say I think it's unlikely that will wind its way up to the Supreme Court. But this decision is enormously helpful in terms of just saying what we were all scared to death about, that there has to be somewhat of a national definition of intellectual disability, that it can't just vary from state to state, that you can be intellectually disabled and eligible for the death penalty in Georgia but not in Alabama, just because of the way the statutes are written or because of the way the state Supreme Courts have interpreted the statutes the way Florida did in this particular case.
Thank you.
At this time, there are no additional questions in the queue. I'd like to turn the conference back over to our presenters for any additional or closing remarks.
I just want to thank Steve again, and thank you to all the participants for joining us on today's call. If you haven't RSVP'd for future calls, please do so. The next one up in the series is this week on Thursday, July 17th at 1 p.m. Eastern, Greenhouse Gas and Environmental Regulation After the 2013 Term, featuring Gerald Torres, Cornell University law professor and a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Environment and Natural Resources Division at the Department of Justice. We also have more calls this month, including on Harris versus Quinn, on the Fourth Amendment, and on McCutcheon and campaign finance reform, so we hope that you'll join us. Thanks again, Steve. We really appreciate it.
Thank you all for being on the call.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.